I was driving across a suspension bridge this morning, right? And usually I'm just looking at the view, maybe checking the traffic. But because I spent all day yesterday reading the papers you sent over, I found myself staring at the steel cables and the girders and thinking, that isn't just a solid block of gray metal, that is a frozen battlefield.
It's a haunting thought when you really dwell on it. We treat steel like this static, permanent thing. We trust our lives to it.
Completely.
But the microstructure, the actual reason the bridge doesn't collapse, is the result of a chaotic, violent race that happened billions of times a second while that metal was cooling down.
And that race is exactly what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into a seminal paper from 1985 by HKDH Padacia titled Diffusional Formation of Ferrite in Iron and Its Alloys.
Right.
Now, I know the title sounds a bit like it belongs in the back of a dusty archive, but this is essentially the biography of an identity crisis, isn't it?
It is. It's the rule book for how iron decides what it wants to be. See,
Mm.
iron is allotropic. It has a split personality.
A split personality.
It can exist in completely different crystal structures depending on the temperature. And Padacia's work here is crucial because he categorized exactly how iron switches from one personality to the other without, falling apart in the process.
So let's set the scene for everyone. We have hot steel. We are way up there in temperature, above 1185 Kelvin. What does the iron look like at the atomic level?
At that temperature, you're looking at austenite. We call this the gamma phase.
Okay.
If you could shrink yourself down, you'd see the atoms stacked in a face-centered cubic structure, or FCC. Imagine a box filled with oranges, packed as tightly as they can possibly go. It's dense, it's symmetrical, and it's very stable, but only while it's hot.
Okay, so we have this dense, hot austenite, but we need to cool it down to make it useful for building things, and this is where the trouble
Right.
starts.
As the temperature drops, that austenite becomes thermodynamically unstable. It's like wearing a heavy winter coat in the middle of summer. It just wants to get out of that structure.
It wants to
It
change.
wants to transform into ferrite or the alpha
Yeah,
ferrite.
and ferrite is different structurally.
Very different. Ferrite is body-centered cubic, or BCC. It's a more open structure. The atoms are less crowded. There's more empty space between them.
So for the iron to change from austenite to ferrite, the atoms have to physically move, they have to break that tight packing and find a looser formation.
Exactly. And according to Vedatia, there are two distinct ways the atoms can pull this off. This distinction seems to be the main pillar of the paper.
The fundamental divide.
It is the fundamental divide in metallurgy. You have the displacive method and the diffusional method.
We used an analogy in prep that I really liked. The displacive method is like a military drill.
That's the best way to visualize it. In a displacive transformation, which gives us something called martensite, the atoms move in a synchronized, coordinated shift.
Okay.
Imagine a platoon of soldiers where everyone takes one step to the left at the exact same instant. It's incredibly fast, it happens at the speed of sound, and it actually changes the shape of the material physically. It creates a shear.
But that's not what we are focusing on today. This paper is about the civilian method.
The diffusional formation, yes. Reconstructive diffusion.
Okay.
This isn't a march, it's a mingle. Imagine a crowded cocktail party where everyone decides to move to the other side of the room.
They don't move in step.
They don't march in step. They bump into each other. They weave through gaps. They diffuse randomly. It's chaotic, uncoordinated, and critically, it requires heat energy to happen.
And Padacci makes a really specific point here about reconstructive diffusion.
Me.
Even if the chemical makeup isn't changing, even if it's pure iron.
The atoms still have to diffuse. That's a key insight.
Yeah.
You might think, if it's just iron atoms rearranging into iron atoms, why do they need to diffuse?
Right, why bother?
But the lattice needs to be torn down and rebuilt. The stacking order is different. You can't just snap the FCC lattice into a BCC lattice without breaking bonds and moving atoms individually. That's why it's reconstructive.
So if the atoms are randomly shuffling around to build this new crystal structure, surely it just grows as a shapeless blob.
You would think so, but nature loves geometry. The ferrite actually grows into very specific shapes. Padacia uses the Dubé classification to categorize them. And the cool thing is, the shape tells you the biography of that specific crystal, where it was born, and what constraints it faced.
Let's walk through the rogues gallery of shapes. The first one mentioned is allotriomorphic ferrite. Now, allotriomorphic implies foreign form. Why that name?
Because it doesn't look like a crystal. It's a conformist. It nucleates. It starts growing at the grain boundaries of the old austenite.
The borders between the crystals.
Exactly. The grain boundary is a high-energy zone. It's disordered, messy. So it's the easiest place for the fairy to start.
Okay.
But because it's stuck between two grains, it can't form pretty geometric facets. It just spreads out along the boundary, wetting the surface like a layer of moss. It hugs the edges of the grain.
So allotriomorphs are the border huggers. They delineate the grains. But then you have the rebels. Idiomorphic fairy.
Why, yeah.
Idio, meaning own form.
These are the isolationists. They don't grow on the boundary. They nucleate deep inside the grain, intragranularly. Usually on a defect, like a speck of dirt or a non-metallic inclusion.
So they have plenty of legroom.
Precisely. Because they aren't squished against a wall or fighting for space at the border, they can grow freely in all directions. They form these perfect, blocky, equiaxed crystals. They get to show off their true crystal symmetry because nothing is stopping them.
And then there's the third one, which sounds a bit more aggressive. Massive ferrite.
Massive ferrite is a fascinating intermediate case. It happens when you cool the steel relatively fast. Fast enough that the atoms don't have time to diffuse long distances, but not so fast that you get the military snap of martensite.
It's caught in the Goldilocks zone of cooling.
In a way. And because it's in a rush, it doesn't respect boundaries. It grows across grain boundaries, swallowing everything in its path. And crucially, it inherits the exact chemical composition of the parent austenite because the alloying elements didn't have time to separate. It's a massive, sweeping change that consumes the microstructure.
This brings us to a really technical but essential part of the paper, the interface. The actual battle line where austenite ends and ferrite begins.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people assume these two crystals just touch, like two Lego bricks clicking together.
It is much, much messier than Legos. You are trying to match two atomic grids of different sizes and different stacking patterns.
Yeah.
If they line up perfectly, we call it coherent. If they're a total mismatch, it's incoherent. But usually, in this type of transformation, it's semi-coherent.
Which means they match up mostly, but every few atoms, the pattern drifts apart.
Exactly. And to fix that drift, nature puts in a stitch. We call it a dislocation.
Like a wrinkle in a rug.
Think of it like a wrinkle in a rug.
Okay.
And here is where Badishi identifies a massive theoretical problem that defines the whole process. If that interface moves, those stitches have to move.
And for a dislocation to move.
It depends on how it moves. Mm-hmm. If it glides, that's easy. But for these semi-coherent interfaces, the dislocations often have to climb. And for a dislocation to climb, atoms have to physically jump into or out of that space.
So mechanically, the interface is locked unless diffusion happens.
Correct. This is the smoking gun for Badishi's argument. Even if the chemistry is identical, the interface structure itself requires diffusion to move. You cannot reconstruct the lattice without atoms shuffling around to fix the misfit at the edge.
This leads us to the speed limit. If atoms have to shuffle, that takes time. In manufacturing, time is money, but in physics, time is kinetics. So what sets the speed limit? Is it how fast the interface can jump? Or is it how fast the atoms can get to the interface?
It's the classic bottleneck question. Interface control versus diffusion control.
Okay.
Imagine a stadium emptying out after a concert. Is the bottleneck the width of the exit door? That's interface control. Or is the bottleneck how fast people can walk down the aisles to get to the door?
That's diffusion control. And for steel?
For almost all commercial steels, it is diffusion controlled. But here is the twist. It's not the iron atoms causing the traffic jam. It's the carbon.
The carbon. But carbon atoms are tiny interstitial guys. They should be fast.
They are fast compared to iron. But ferrite hates carbon. Remember, ferrite is that BCC structure. It's open. But the specific little holes where carbon likes to sit are actually smaller and less comfortable than an austenite.
Ah, so as the ferrite grows, it rejects the carbon.
It pushes it out.
Like a snow plow pushing snow in front of it?
Perfect analogy. The ferry pushes a wave of carbon into the austenite ahead of it. This creates a pileup. The concentration of carbon right in front of the interface skyrockets.
And the ferrite can't move?
It cannot move forward until that carbon diffuses away into the bulk of the material.
So the entire growth of the crystal is held hostage by how fast the carbon can clear out.
Exactly. The interface is ready to go, but it's waiting for the carbon to move. This assumes something called local equilibrium.
Explain that, because it sounds like a contradiction if things are moving.
It's a boundary condition. It assumes that right at the touching point, the single atomic layer where the two phases meet, the austenite and ferrite, are chemically balanced. They are happy with each other. based on the local concentration.
So the drama isn't at the interface.
The drama isn't happening at the interface. It's happening in the concentration gradient, just ahead of it.
Okay, so that's the story for plain carbon steel. But the paper gets really interesting and honestly a little brain-bending when we add a third character, manganese.
Ah, the manganese problem.
Ah.
This is the heart of Padeshi's analysis on alloys. This is where the simple diffusion story gets complicated.
So let's break down the cast of characters. Mm. We have iron, the host. We have carbon, the fast sprinter. And now manganese.
And manganese is a substitutional atom. It replaces an iron atom in the grid. It's big, it's heavy, and it moves like molasses.
Right. Carbon zips through the gaps.
Carbon can zip through the interstitial gaps. Manganese has to shoulder its way through the iron lattice, vacancy by vacancy. It is orders of magnitude slower.
So now you have a tug of war?
You do. The transformation wants to happen. The carbon runs away quickly, but the manganese is just sitting there blocking the path.
So what happens? Does the interface wait for the slow manganese to move, or does it just run it over?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer depends entirely on how thirsty this system is to transform. We call this supersaturation, or driving force.
Let's start with the polite scenario. High temperature, low driving force.
In this case, the system isn't in a huge rush. The driving force is low. So the interface moves slowly enough that it actually waits for the manganese. This is called PLE, partitioning local equilibrium.
Partitioning means it's moving.
Moving apart. The manganese partitions. It diffuses out of the growing ferrite and piles up in the austenite, just like the carbon does.
So the ferrite ends up very pure, with very little manganese.
Correct. But because it's waiting for the slow guy, the growth must be agonizingly slow.
Which you can't have in a factory.
It is. If you're making steel industrially, you usually don't have time for this. You're cooling things down faster.
So what happens when we drop the temperature? The driving force goes up. The steel is screaming, I need to become ferrite right now.
Now the system stops being polite.
Mm-hmm.
You enter the NPLE regime, negligible partitioning local equilibrium.
Negligible partitioning. So the manganese stops moving.
Effectively, yes. The interface starts moving too fast for the manganese to diffuse away. It engulfs the manganese. The ferrite grows with the manganese trapped inside it. It inherits the parent composition.
So if the austenite had 2% manganese, the ferrite has 2% manganese.
Correct. But, and this is the brilliant, subtle nuance Padeshi highlights, we still have to satisfy local equilibrium. The laws of thermodynamics don't just disappear because we're in a hurry.
So how does it satisfy the rules if the manganese isn't moving?
The spike. Even though the bulk of the manganese is getting swallowed right at the interface, we're talking a few nanometers, a tiny atomic layer, there is a spike in manganese concentration.
A spike? What do you mean a spike?
Imagine a wave pushing a tiny pile of sand just inches in front of it. It doesn't clear the whole beach, but it pushes just enough sand right at the wavefront to satisfy the math.
So it partitions locally?
It partitions locally, just at the interface, but it doesn't diffuse far enough to escape.
That is a fascinating compromise. The system effectively cheats. It follows the thermodynamic rules for that one nanometer, but ignores them for the rest of the material.
Exactly. It's a compromise between thermodynamic desire and kinetic reality. The carbon is still controlling the speed. It's diffusing ahead of this whole mess. But the manganese is trapped in this weird local spike behavior.
I love that phrase, kinetic reality. But speaking of reality, we have to talk about solute trapping, because this part sounded less like physics and more like a hostage situation.
It really is. Solute trapping happens when the interface moves at extremely high speeds, usually at much lower temperatures or very high driving forces.
So we've gone past the polite PLE phase, past the compromise NPLE phase, and now we are in a full sprint.
Correct. In solute trapping, the interface moves so fast that the atoms like manganese are engulfed by the new crystal structure before they can even wiggle. The spike disappears. The local equilibrium breaks down.
But here's the part that blew my mind. The manganese is now in the ferrite. But structurally, chemically, does it want to be there?
Yeah, that's the key. Its chemical potential actually increases. In plain English, the manganese is less stable in the ferrite than it was in the austenite. It has been forced into a higher energy state.
That feels like it breaks the golden rule of nature. Always seek the lowest energy. We're taught that atoms always want to go to the lowest energy state.
It breaks the individual rule, but it follows the collective rule. The overall energy drop of the massive amount of iron transforming is so huge that it pays the penalty for the manganese.
So it pays for it.
It drags the manganese uphill, energetically speaking.
It's like a crowd stampede. You might not want to go through the door, but if 10,000 people behind you are pushing, you're going through the door whether you like it or not.
That is Salu trapping, perfectly described. And it creates a material state that is technically not in equilibrium. It is a captured moment. A frozen accident.
And this leads to the final concept in the paper, perequilibrium, which sounds like a contradiction in terms.
Perequilibrium is a frozen state. Imagine cooling so fast that the iron and manganese atoms, the substitutional lattice atoms, are physically locked in place. They cannot switch spots. They are immobile.
But the carbon?
The carbon is still small enough and fast enough to move. So you get this strange situation where the skeleton of the building is frozen, the iron and manganese cannot renovate, but the tenants, the carbon atoms, are still running around trying to make deals.
So the ferry inherits the exact iron to manganese ratio of the austenite. It has no choice, but the carbon diffuses to balance the energy between the two phases.
Exactly. It's a partial equilibrium. The heavy atoms are stuck. The light atoms are negotiating the peace treaty. The ratio of iron to manganese remains constant everywhere, but the carbon varies.
This whole discussion really challenges the idea I had that equilibrium is a binary switch. Like, either it's balanced or it's not. But Hadashia is showing us it's a spectrum.
That is the key takeaway.
Yeah.
In the real world, especially in industrial steel processing, we almost never see true textbook equilibrium. We see these intermediate states, periequilibrium, NPLE, salute trapping.
Right.
And understanding which one you are in determines if your pipeline bursts under pressure or if your car chassis crumples safely to save your life.
Because if you get the speed wrong or the cooling rate wrong, you get the wrong crystal structure.
You get the wrong properties.
Mm.
If you want a steel that is tough and ductile, you might need to allow that diffusion to happen. Let the carbon move, let the manganese partition. If you want something hard and brittle,
you suppress it.
You suppress it. We are essentially managing a race between the interface velocity and the diffusion speed.
And the winner of that race builds the world we live in.
It does. It dictates the safety factors of our infrastructure.
Before we wrap up, I want to touch on soft impingement. We talk about the ferry growing and pushing that wave of carbon. But eventually, in a real piece of steel, there are other grains nearby.
Right. Real steel isn't infinite. As the ferry grows, it pushes that carbon pile up further out. Eventually, that wave hits the wall of the next grain, or it hits the wave coming from another growing ferrite particle.
It's like cleaning a garage. You can sweep the dust to the center, but eventually, you run out of floor space.
Exactly. The diffusion fields overlap. The carbon has nowhere left to go. The concentration in the remaining austenite shoots up, the driving force drops, and the growth slows down to a crawl. This is soft impingement. It's the reality of a crowded system.
So bringing it all back together, we've gone from the military march of Martin Sight to the civilian shuffle of Ferret. We've seen the border-hugging allotriomorphs and the lonely idiomorphs. We've watched carbon run the show while manganese gets trapped against its will.
It's a complex dance, a very complex dance.
I want to leave the listeners with that image of salute trapping. We always assume nature is efficient, finding the perfect balance for every atom. But Padoshi shows us that sometimes the momentum of change is just too strong. The wave crashes and the atoms get trapped where they stand, happy or not.
It's a snapshot of a struggle frozen in time. That's what a steel beam really is.
Exactly. Yeah. So next time you look at a skyscraper or a bridge, remember the chaos locked inside that cold metal. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.